with fear, you can definitely sell it. That's just how it is. And that's why there's talk of cyber attacks again, etc. We always have to look very closely. And even though we discuss things on a daily basis, we often let a day pass for some reports and wait for follow-up reports before we really consider it a case.
Welcome to Cybersecurity Shall Be C-Level Priority, the podcast that puts the digital world to the test. Cyber attacks are on the rise, and data is the most valuable asset in today's world. But how can we protect what matters most to us? Drawing on the latest insights, effective strategies, and practical tips, we'll show you how to create a more secure digital environment. Because one thing is clear, security isn't negotiable, it's a top priority.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Cybersecurity is a Top Priority, the podcast today with Kerstin. Hello, Kerstin.
Good morning, Nico. I'm glad to be here.
For everyone who doesn't know you yet, could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, my name is Kerstin Zettel-Schabert. I'm a cyber conflict researcher at the University of Heidelberg. I'm actually a political scientist, so I'm not a technician, but I've been dealing with cyber operations for about 6 or 7 years now, mainly in research projects that have produced a quantitative data set on publicly known cyber operations. Then, based on this data, I analyze these cyber operations. So it's mainly about the actors involved. It's about proxies, it's about state actors, and it's about escalation. It's also a bit about things like what influence does the regime type of each state have on cyber conflict behavior. So the whole topic of cybersecurity, or rather, what happens in cyberspace from a social science conflict perspective. Exactly. And currently, I'm working on the research project, European Repository of Cyber Incidents, or Europol for short, which is funded by the Foreign Office.
Yes, we have an exciting topic. And here's the first question. Are we already in a cyber Armageddon? That's our topic for today. But maybe before you answer the question, could you explain for everyone what a cyber Armageddon means to you?
It's good that you said for you, because I think can't really answer it neutrally and objectively without your personal perspective. So there isn't a fixed definition, at least none that I'm aware of. I wouldn't just want to focus on cyber Armageddon, but on this whole conglomerate of terms like cyber Pearl Harbor, cyber 911, and also, in my view, cyber war. So these are all terms that try to create analogies to events or concepts from the conventional conflict sphere. When you think of Armageddon, you naturally think of some totally catastrophic event where the end times are approaching. I don't think I need to elaborate much on 9/11. It's obviously about a very serious, violent act of terrorism. And in the end, it's about transferring that to cyberspace and looking or thinking about whether there might also be actions in cyberspace that could exhibit a similar intensity of conflict and potentially lead to a similar escalation of conflict. And especially when you look at the example of cyber Pearl Harbor, I mean, Pearl Harbor, of course, led to the US becoming active in the nuclear weapons area. So that was clearly perceived as an event that crossed a red line. Have we seen anything like that in cyberspace yet? From my perspective, not really. I don't want to dive too deep into the whole cyber conflict research literature at this point, but what we've actually seen in the last 10 to 15 years, especially in the last 10 years, is that cyber operations are used less as a means of military conflict and more as a political tool. And the fact that we still haven't seen this standalone, very serious cyber incident that has not only caused physical effects, but also actual human harm, that's why I personally find it very difficult to deal with such analogies like cyber Pearl Harbor, but also cyber war, cyber Armageddon, because from my perspective, it somewhat distracts from what cyber operations actually are today, or rather, by which actors, in what context, and for what purposes they are used. From my perspective, it's not primarily used as a standalone military means of conflict. Of course, they are also used in conflicts like, for example, used in Ukraine, but they are always supported. It's mainly about gathering information, which isn't anything new. So the need for intelligence gathering in the context of conflicts has been the case for centuries. But of course, cyberspace offers completely different possibilities. But what we don't see is that cyber operations, cyber conflicts really cause, for example, causing warlike effects, actually harming people, And that's why, even when it comes to the question of how we can respond to cyber operations, what preventive measures we should take, this primarily militarily, our connoted perspective, in my view, directs the focus. I believe it's much more about strengthening our own defenses rather than putting on that military lens. And then I think we could also effectively fend off many, many cyber operations. I think it's much more about strengthening our own defenses rather than putting on that military lens. And then I think we could also fend off many, many cyber operations much more effectively.
That brings us to actually another topic of the survey, but I think it fits really well right now. The other topic that often comes up with these issues, especially when we talk about cyber warfare, is the topic of hackback. So it's really a hot topic right now with the various legislations that are currently in the works, where people often say, hey, we need to be able to hack back too in 2021. Do you see that as the part that could lead to an Armageddon if the attacker or the one being attacked also strikes back and in the end there's this chain reaction? You also gave the example with Pearl Harbor where there was, in quotes, a reaction. Or do you see it differently, cyberspace compared to classical warfare?
In fact, it's the case that cyber operations regularly do not provoke a 1,000 reactions in the physical conventional world. Even in the cyber conflict domain, it's rather rare, or rather, cyber operations have so far been used more in a de-escalating manner, at least from a democratic perspective. What's more is that we've also seen in the past, for example, I think a very striking example is the US election in 2016, when the Russians have launched various attempts at influence or even manipulation in cyberspace. Of course, first and foremost, the DNC hack and leak, where data from Hillary Clinton and her team was hacked and leaked. In this context, we now know that the US administration, Obama, was considering how to respond, how we should respond, should we, for example, also somehow strike back in cyberspace. Of course, there was also talk about sanctions, but within the crisis team, if you will, there was also discussion about, well, could we, for example, could we somehow hack back? Could we hack Putin? Could we steal some sensitive information? But it's not all that trivial, not so simple for hackbacks in a retaliatory sense, if you will. One question is whether it's allowed from the perspective of international or actually retaliatory strikes are not allowed. It should always be about containing or reducing an ongoing attack or its consequences. And the question is, of course, always about the technical feasibility, because if you want to strike back within a certain time frame after an attack has occurred, you also need some access to the target system, or rather, you first have to identify target systems. So with Putin, you could now, for example, ask the question, okay, where are there potentially compromising information for him? How can we access it? Do we actually have access? Do we, for example, any vulnerabilities on the part of the NSA that we could use for that? What could an attack structure look like? So it's all not so trivial, especially considering the short amount of time that often has to be available for a response to actually be called a reaction. And the question is always, what effect are you trying to achieve with that? So what do you want to achieve with a hackback? Do you want to carry out pure retaliation now? Do you actually want to deter the attacker from such harmful operations in the future or not? So also to achieve a certain deterrence, and all of this is fundamentally viewed with a lot of skepticism. I mean, with Putin, for example, we've also seen that Navalny, the deceased opposition leader, has indeed leaked very sensitive information, repeatedly spreading it in a very public way. It hasn't really harmed Putin in the long term up to this day. That's why I think this whole hackback debate in Germany is also a bit shaped by the vagueness of the definition. I think the federal government is still a bit hesitant to actually define hackbacks. You just say, okay, we distance ourselves from hackbacks, we don't do that, but what we actually don't want to do, we don't really say that. And that's why I think this whole debate in Germany is still conceptually quite vague, relatively unclear about who means what with which measures. I believe active cyber defense measures can definitely make sense, especially when it comes to, for example, to somehow redirect harmful traffic, especially when it comes to working with providers in the context of public-private partnerships who are actually capable and authorized to, for example, to patch any systems so that some authority, which maybe doesn't even have a legal basis for it, doesn't have to access them from the outside. But it's also actually going in the direction of honeypots. It's also about how you can obtain information for attribution. So all of these are measures that are, of course, much lower on the scale than hackbacks, much less intrusive, and also pose much less risk, especially regarding collateral damage. And these are all measures that, in my view, definitely have a legitimacy. But this whole hackback debate is, in my view, still very politically charged, and it's still not quite clear which measures you want to use for what purpose and what goal, because that's also something I take away from the last few years. Of course, there were also more and more strategies that were adopted, cybersecurity strategy, but also the national security strategy, where the word cyber appears a whopping 62 times. So it's very, 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 very prominent. But what often seems to be missing is the evaluation of the effectiveness and efficiency of strategies afterwards. So are the measures being proposed actually helpful and sensible in achieving the intended goal? And I think those are some issues in German cybersecurity policy that should be addressed in the coming years.
So what always resonates with me regarding the topic of hackbacks is, as you just mentioned, this question of whether you want to take revenge or if you want to extract information with it. If you want to take revenge, I personally believe, in my opinion, that we would then create a much bigger problem, because we would then incur the wrath of the attacker and we wouldn't necessarily be able to respond effectively from a technical standpoint, from a personnel standpoint, from a resource standpoint, but also in terms of what we are allowed to do or not do. And that's why I always find this debate very interesting. I agree with you that there are many advantages to doing it in a structured way. The other point is, if you see it as retaliation, I think we would receive a lot of anger, or let's say a lot of pushback, which we wouldn't get otherwise, and that would lead to even more problems.
Absolutely. And it's also the case that for the most part, we find ourselves, not always, but for the most part, in the situation of democracy versus autocracy. And of course, it's also the case that in cyberspace, you could say, maybe fortunately, because the free open internet, free discourse, freedom of opinion, freedom of speech, all of that is present in democracies. But that also leads to the fact that the attack surface for cyber operations, especially when they enter the realm of information warfare, if you want to call it that, hybrid conflict means we are, of course, much more vulnerable than autocracies. I mean, just imagine Iran, or, of course, the most extreme example, maybe North Korea, where everything is much more isolated, much more closed off. It's, of course, much harder for democracies, for example, to actually retaliate. So against North Korea, apart from sanctions and applying political pressure, we haven't really found the right means to, for example, to actually hinder the country's clear weapons program. And that's why, yes, from my perspective, it's a very, very difficult topic. I completely agree with what you said. It's also a bit like the saying, those who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. So, of course, the USA can be seen as a cyber hegemon, having the largest and strongest cyber capabilities in the world. At the same time, if you take a look at the publicly available attack statistics, it's clear that the most vulnerable country in the world seems to be losing the most. And yet, in recent years, especially under Donald Trump, they have taken on an increasingly offensive perspective or positioning regarding cyber conflict. And we have, for example, we saw that in 2010, after Stuxnet was revealed, it was a wake-up call for autocracies, including China, which increased their capabilities. They then intensified their efforts to infiltrate US systems, increased spying. Thus, I believe hackbacks aren't the most effective long-term strategy for cybersecurity resilience. You have deeper insights into technical resilience, especially German systems, and I'd rather not discuss that today. So I believe that actually responding with hackbacks in cyberspace is probably not the most efficient or effective way in the long run to strengthen your own cybersecurity in terms of resilience. But I think when it comes to technical resilience, you definitely have much deeper insights than I do, especially regarding German systems. And I'd rather not get into that today.
But back to our topic of cyber Armageddon. And even though, as you mentioned, it's actually an umbrella term and a buzzword for many other topics, it also means that a lot, or in the case of cyber Armageddon, it's about spreading chaos, panic, and insecurity as a means, or the means to ultimately achieve a result, to destabilize, to attack, and so on. Now I see these issues, especially when it comes to the topic of panic, where chaos is often present. in cyberspace, not necessarily in relation to the political level, but also a lot from the attacker's perspective, where they obviously want to achieve something, want to cause harm, and so on. Do you see this as a precursor to an Armageddon, or do you think, no, for me, a cyber Armageddon is really, as Hollywood often describes it, total panic, chaos? Everything is uncertain, and the world basically stops functioning. I can't remember the name of that Netflix series, but it described it so well back then, where suddenly everything went down and there was no communication anymore.
I think there's actually a series called Cyber Armageddon. I think it's on Prime, but I'm not sure now. Well, anyway, I actually wouldn't want to use the term Cyber Armageddon for what we're currently seeing. I think it mainly refers to the more cumulative effects of individual operations, which, when taken together, can still develop a very significant impact over time. So these ongoing pinpricks, if you will, and of course, as you said, if someone wants to create chaos, maybe instill distrust, especially in a democratic population, towards their own security agencies and their own politics, for example, the goal is also to say, okay, the population should really lose trust in the fact that the state still has control in cyberspace, that the security agencies actually have something to counter cybercrime and state-sponsored actors. I think you can definitely say that this is probably the case. However, there isn't enough research yet on the question of how the gap between perceived damage intensity and, if you will, actual damage intensity looks in the context of cyber operations and cybercrime. That's why, for example, also the cyber agency in Halle this year, for example, also published a specific call for proposals on the question of how to measure damages from cybercrime, for example. And I think when we talk about chaos, when we talk about these psychological effects, we immediately think of ransomware today, because ransomware often has publicly visible effects, especially when it affects critical infrastructures. Measure. And I think when we talk about chaos, when we talk about these psychological effects, we immediately think of ransomware today, because ransomware often has publicly visible effects, especially when it affects critical infrastructures. And I mean, these days, hardly a week goes by without some new reports about a ransomware incident against, I don't know, a hospital, a university, a municipality, etc. And I think when you look at it over a long period, it can really create the impression that you're somehow defenseless, that you can't do anything, and that even the security agencies can't do anything. And this is really a very, very interesting topic. I don't want to dive too deep into it, but since I personally deal with it, there's also the question of what emotions, for example, cyber operations evoke in people who are directly or indirectly affected by them. That was, for example, in the context of the ransomware operation or the ransomware incident against the Dusseldorf hospital, I don't know, 2021, 2020, do you remember that? I'm not sure right now. Yeah, okay, exactly. So that caused quite a stir, because it was also investigated whether a death was actually directly related to it. The investigation then concluded no, but what this study definitely showed based on this specific example is that in cyber operations, for example, in contrast to terrorist acts, where those directly or indirectly affected tend to experience emotions like fear and anxiety, and less so, for example, anger. So in the case of terrorist acts, it's often the case that the public is angry at these attackers. Of course, there's always a certain fear, but anger prevails. And there's this kind of rally around the flag effect, where people, for example, also expresses a lack of trust in their own security agencies and to support them. And in cyber operations, at least this research suggested, it could be that, for example, ransomware operations tend to erode trust in security agencies, leading to a loss of confidence. And I think it's really, 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 really important for the future to consider how to counteract this. So as security agencies, partly in public communication after cyber operations, so that you, for example, communicate during that time and also counteract a bit of the misperception of actual damages. Because often it's really not as catastrophic as it's portrayed. And I think that's really, really important also in terms of a crisis emergency management plan, maybe also in terms of business continuity management, if you think about it further. Yeah, that's about all I would say on that.
But you're touching on a topic that I always say in the private sector, communication is key. Also, the topic that cyberspace, let's just call it cyberspace, is not tangible for many people. So when they see something happening, how do I deal with it? Then, of course, you have a lot of people with question marks because they just can't grasp it. What does it mean now that the data has been leaked? And then there's often this topic of I've been hacked. So how often do I hear in my circle of acquaintances, I've been hacked? And then I always ask, so yeah, what actually happened? And then it turns out later, no, I wasn't hacked. I just had a bad password or I clicked on the link or whatever. So I think that's still a huge issue, that the whole area of cyber, digitalization, and computers isn't really tangible for a lot of people, what's actually happening in the background. And then a big press agency comes along and writes that the next hospital has been hacked. I have that, for example, seen at One Quiet, maybe 2001. Can you also give your feedback on how you saw that back then? WannaCry was poorly programmed ransomware technologically, which was also easily shut down by the kill switch, and everything was back up and running. It attacked hospitals, airports, and companies in the maritime sector, affecting many people. German Railway was a prominent example, with concerns about trains not running anymore. But because it really attacked hospitals, airports, and a lot of companies in the maritime sector, many were affected by it. A very striking example for us was the German Railway, where people often talked about, oh no, it's everything terrible now, and the trains aren't running anymore, or there are problems with this, that, and the other. There's a lot going on there. I don't really like this word, but there was a lot of fear, so people didn't even know what was happening in the background. And I have, for example, safety and signaling systems were unaffected, only station displays were impacted. This likely caused fear for many. The safety systems, the signaling systems, everything that ensures the safety of the train was never affected. It was just the displays at the train station. But I can imagine that for many people, this leads to a state of anxiety, or it led to a state of insecurity, even though, let's say, the impact from a technical standpoint wasn't that significant. Do you see that in your research too, that often when something like ransomware hits, you initially have no idea what's going on or how serious it is, that it tends to turn into a fear story?
Yes, definitely. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, our research project captures publicly known cyber operations and tries to assess them in terms of technical, political, and legal categories. We start by checking for CIA triad violations and technical impacts. We exclude pure scans. We rely on public info, often including media reports. Media isn't always clear, even for threat intelligence. And since we naturally have to rely on publicly available information, this often includes media reports. But I don't want to just throw the media in there. I think sometimes, even with threat intelligence companies, things might not always be so clear-cut and defined. With fear, you can definitely sell it. Exactly.
You can definitely sell fear.
Exactly. That's just how it is. Exactly, definitely. And that's why there's talk of cyber attacks again, etc. We always have to look very closely. And even though we discuss things on a daily basis, we often let a day pass for some reports and wait for follow-up reports before we really consider it a case and include it in our newsletter, which you can subscribe to. Because the initial reports are often really very, very, I don't want to say sensationalist, but they're often quite inaccurate. Of course, the information available is often very thin. Then parts of things that actually have no connection to cyber at all, which might just be the result of some human errors, are directly turned into a cyber attack. That's why I believe, as you said, especially in regard to the general public, who obviously don't have the deeper knowledge or understanding of how things work and what can actually be triggered by cyber operations. From my perspective, the media are actually very, very important knowledge intermediaries, if you will, who unfortunately also jump on this bandwagon and prefer to talk about a cyber attack right away. So for example, even with cyber espionage, I always want to, and I probably won't succeed, but I always want to avoid calling it a cyber attack, because you could maybe compare it a bit to a burglary. You might not always immediately call it an attack. That's exactly why I believe the media are very, very important. And maybe another example from the last few weeks, there are always reports that some company, for example, has gone bankrupt or insolvent due to a cyber operation. But I think it really misses the reality that this might have just been the last straw, while there were certainly other factors or circumstances in the chain that had already put the company in a difficult position. Has now gone bankrupt, gone broke, or become insolvent due to a cyber operation. but it misses the reality that this might have been the last straw, while there were other factors that put the company in a difficult position. The report says company XY went bankrupt because of cyber operation XY. People hear that and not dig deeper, thinking they're taking our companies because of a cyber operation. But then the report often comes out saying company XY went bankrupt because of cyber operation XY. And I think that leads to people hearing something like that and not looking into it more deeply, thinking, wow, this is crazy. They're taking down our companies because of a cyber operation. And that's not the case. Another example, you probably heard about this too, this milking system or whatever it was. That was basically a similar example. So the cause and effect relationships are often not presented the way they should be. So I think sometimes it's better not to report right away and maybe wait to see how the information develops and then report when you know more.
I found that too, for example. That Hamas phone story, it's really striking. Within minutes, everyone was talking about attacks themselves, saying the phones were hacked and the batteries were made to explode and so on. And I always think from a technical perspective, if you take a step back and consider how that could work, it's not that simple. And I always found it really interesting, even in my security bubble, that many people on LinkedIn immediately started talking about the cyber attack, saying the phones were hacked, this, that, and the other. In 2021, reports gradually started coming in that explosives must have been involved. The claim of a cyber attack persisted for a very long time. And I think that's often the issue. Of course, it could have been triggered by a remote detonation that you, let's say, did over the internet or through the phone network or whatever, which set off the bomb. So the trigger could have been a cyber attack, whatever you want to call it, that ultimately led to the explosives going off. But it wasn't that the phone was hacked or anything like that, but through the battery parameters. They weren't even phones. It was more like the pager battery exploded due to some kind of manipulation or whatever. I often see, that a cyber attack can lead to another consequence that is much worse. That can happen more often. Or that you use cyberspace as a gateway, that's also very common, but it's not always the cyber attack that ultimately triggers everything.
From my perspective, this also shows that we need to fundamentally ask ourselves, especially if we actually want to cause physical effects and maybe even kill people, should cyber operations really be the method of choice? So for example, you can also see this with Russia in the Ukraine war. If they really want to destroy any energy infrastructure in the long run, they don't do it with some sophisticated cyber operations where they have to conduct reconnaissance for months and where in the end it might all go wrong because of some patch. Often you can't even assess the collateral damage or how it will all work out as we imagine. So they just drop bombs instead. Or of course, right now the use of drones is also being discussed a lot. You just can't really assess whether everything works out the way we imagine. So you tend to just drop bombs instead. Or of course, right now, use of drones is also being discussed a lot. That's why when you use terms like cyber war, cyber Pearl Harbor, cyber Armageddon with military connotations, it alters how cyber operations work. They exist in a gray zone between war and peace. More in this corridor, we often find ourselves. We have a full-scale war between Russia and Ukraine, but we're often lower on the conflict and escalation ladder. They're more in this, as they say, gray zone between war and peace. Actually more in this corridor where we find ourselves more and more often, of course. In 2011, we had a total war that had actually escalated, if you will, between Russia and Ukraine. But it is often the case that we do not yet have this state of conflict, that we are still further down the conflict ladder, the escalation ladder. And that's where cyber operations are often a method of choice, especially on the information-laden level, if you will.
Maybe one last question for you, which I'm personally interested in, especially from your research perspective. What can we do to protect ourselves against this? We keep talking about technical measures, organizational measures, and processes, but often the technology is put in the foreground. What do you see from your research? What should we be doing more of?
I really believe, though, that even though this topic is probably often beaten to death, education is extremely important. I mean, the whole generation that's coming up now, who will probably have to protect our systems, which will be much more complex in 10, 15, or 20 years, they need to be prepared for that. So I think education really needs to be invested in much more. I can only speak for myself. Of course, it's been a few years, but I would have really liked it if I had been taught more basic IT skills. I think that's a very, very important aspect. Of course, especially when we get into the area of disinformation, education needs to be involved there too. There's this term I'm trying to think of, but it's about how kids and teenagers need to be introduced to social media so they can better assess whether a source is trustworthy or not. So what I think has been happening for many years now, it's of course a very, very complex topic, especially when it comes to the area of disinformation. Disinformation impacts all ages. Reaching older groups is tough without schools. Governments must boost IT security, focusing on defense. Basics like MFA, patching and training are key but often ignored. Reaching them is a different challenge. Strengthening its security by focusing on defense and implementing processes is crucial. It's not just about preventing every attack. Prevention often boils down to basics: MFA, patching, and training. We struggle to implement it effectively. It's not easy. And I think that's definitely more your area of expertise, but it shouldn't just be about, well, we can't defend against and prevent every attack, which I think is certainly true. However, even as a non-technical person, I notice when I read all these threat intelligence reports where everything is described in detail, that when it comes to the section on what could have been done to prevent it, it always seems to come down to the same three or four basics: MFA, patching, employee training. And I think, okay, it's always the same. And yet we somehow fail to really get that into people's heads and actually implement it. So that's why I think it's all not that simple. I don't think it's something that can be solved in a single causal way on just one track. In 2001, I think what you mentioned about crisis communication from government authorities, I think that could and definitely should be intensified. Because maybe, to give one last example, when we talk about damage, it's not just about what the attacker does, but also about how the victim responds to it. So damages are often also about what the victims make of it or how the victims react. And if we, for example, how victims react, and when we think about, for example, think about the Colonial Pipeline hack in the USA, I believe that was also in 2020, then we saw, for example, we saw that many of the blow-up damages, like, for example, there was a shortage at all the gas stations, etc., that it wasn't direct result of the cyber operation, which actually didn't affect the OT, but I believe it was the billing system or something like that. Exactly. But in my opinion, I think that a little bit more, less extensive, less controlled and unnecessary communication from the authorities also led to panic buying. And that's why I think if we want to prevent such follow-up or cascading damages, especially when we're talking about critical infrastructure and sensitive areas, it's really about managing that from a governmental side in a crisis mode to be able to contain the damage more effectively.
Above all, we would also need to address the areas that are under constant fire. And this is a record that I keep repeating, especially regarding critical infrastructure. Let's take municipalities. As an example, you mentioned municipalities earlier, and there was some great legislation that kept getting thrown out because people said, no, we don't need that, and so on. I believe, and I keep saying this, it's a mindset issue for me. We just have to manage to change this mindset for everyone to get this understanding. And I agree with you. In my school days, I learned Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and a bit of programming. When I look at it these days and this media literacy, I think that was the word.
Exactly, media literacy. Thank you.
Yes, that's also a topic close to my heart. I've talked a lot about this in the podcast, and I'm also actively involved here for my kids at school. Then I keep running into the problem that the focus is always just on the media literacy issue, what kids are allowed to post. Or rather, when it comes to data protection, it sometimes becomes a matter of overregulation for me. I find it pretty crazy what parents or even kids are doing regarding data protection. Oh, you sent my kid around on WhatsApp, I'm going to sue you for that. Or, oh, you took a picture of a kid without putting a sun or a smiley on it, and so on. Where I regularly have the discussion, yes, okay, everything is nice and good, but just take a look at the other side, which is just as important and relevant, and not just always this data protection issue. And for me, that includes this mindset change, and especially that we also give the people who are supposed to explain this, namely the teaching staff, the support they need. Because, of course, teaching staff have no experience with that. Well, you could see that during the corona period, with some teachers, it was already a struggle to use something like Teams to be allowed to use 2021, not because they can't do it now, but because they weren't allowed to, or because they don't know how to handle it, because the licensing issue hasn't been clarified. We could easily make an entire podcast just about that. But you can see that we need to invest even more in this area, and that we have to do more. And I'm also addressing my bubble here, that we as security experts need to do a lot more ourselves. But I have to say, fairly, you're also limited there, because in the end, especially with media literacy, it's always about data protection and not about security in the broader sense. And this mindset change has to happen. And I believe that if we do this step by step, then the external perception of a possible cyber Armageddon, or if we ever face something like that, will be completely different than it is now.
But what do you think needs to happen for us to actually see this mindset change? So we've already seen many serious cyber operations, and obviously none of that has led to it happening. So what do you think needs to happen, maybe as an external event, for that to really be the case? I mean, the economic damages have been widely discussed now, and that should really be clear to everyone by now.
I think we need to change the way we approach it and not deal with fear anymore. For me, a huge issue, and I keep saying this, is dealing with fear. This question alone. The question isn't if you'll be attacked. The question is when you'll be attacked. All these things create one thing, and that is fear. It's just like if I were to go to a CEO and say, look, there's NIS2 and DORA, and if you don't do this, you'll lose this much money or you'll have this problem. A CEO has a lot of issues to deal with, and cyber is just one of them. And what I keep seeing is 2021, one is dealing with fear, and the other topic is communication on a completely different level. So if I, for example, go into a company and especially advise a company in the area of cybersecurity or also on this topic of awareness, awareness is not just a fairness training or a phishing campaign. That's always a huge problem. Everyone sees awareness as I buy a great tool and then I run a phishing campaign and an awareness training. No, that's not awareness. For me, awareness in 2021 is about emotionally engaging people with the topic. And how do I achieve that? By showing them that, hey, this doesn't just affect you at work, it also affects you personally. For example, I do life hacks that have nothing to do with the company. So when I do an awareness training or an awareness life hacking at trade shows and events, or even with our clients, I always include the personal level. I say it affects you personally just as much, because we are simply built that way, or so many people think that way, that we just assume, okay, in the company, I have an IT department. I might even have a security department. They take care of everything. So I, as an end user, don't have to do anything. And then I keep coming back to this topic of usability versus security. I have some great security measures, but I don't like them. Or let's just say in German, it takes me 10 more minutes to log in. So I'm trying to find ways around it so I can save those 10 minutes. And if you can't manage to engage people on an emotional level, I do that really well by including the personal aspect. Look, this affects you personally just as much, because then the questions come up, oh, what can I do about it? But I don't want my surveillance camera to be visible to everyone and so on. And I think those are the things where we can achieve a mindset change. We need to move away from fear-based topics. The press is to blame for sensationalizing events, leading to attacks on companies. Lessons learned are ignored. A hospital led to a podcast documenting providing insights. The Simplicissimus documentary on Putin's bears highlighted for understanding fear holds us back, preventing progress. Lessons learned aren't focused. The hospital case led to a podcast documenting everything, a valuable experience. They discussed it saying, let's talk about this. Similarly, the Simplicissimus report on Putin's bears highlighted the issue, fostering understanding. Fear culture in society today holds people back and prevents progress. As you said, it's not just the media. The IT security field also plays a role. The report or the documentary you were part of from Simplicissimus about Putin's bears, where they just talk about it, highlight it, and allow for some understanding. I see a lot of fear culture in our society today, and this fear holds people back, which is why we can't move forward on the topic.
As you mentioned, it's not just the media. But I also think the IT security field plays a role in this. The products need to be sold too. So fear definitely helps when it comes to saying, okay, our product is the only thing standing between you and the next very serious cyber incident. And I have to tell you, and this is the next mistake, cybersecurity is not just a technology.
So please stop seeing a firewall as your all-in-one solution or a magic bullet or whatever it is, like a 7 system or IDS system. What I meant earlier is that a comprehensive security concept includes technology, processes, people, and the context of the company. And I agree with you, our security bubble is very product-focused right now. It's gotten better in recent years. Yeah, he says that's gotten worse again because of AI, because now the next big thing is being hyped up, namely AI. Our tools can suddenly do AI, and AI does everything, and AI is there for that. I recently did an interesting podcast on the topic of AI pen testing, where there are companies saying, hey, we do fully automated pen tests. And I'm like, oh my God, just stay away from that. It can't possibly work. But in the end, it's like I always say, it's just another drop on the stone. And the media is part of it. And the technology consultants are part of it. And we mustn't forget, in the end, there's a huge market in the cybersecurity field. Of course, there are also many market players who take advantage of that. The ignorance of the customers, I keep saying that snake oil salesman is really the magic word for that. They're everywhere, not just in the cybersecurity field, but especially in cybersecurity. I see it time and again, because you have to look at it this way. I always say that I have no idea about cars. In 2021, when my car breaks down, I call the roadside assistance or the towing service. If a company has no idea about cybersecurity or information security, it hires a consultant. How is the company supposed to know if the consultant is good or bad, or if the consultant is really representing my interests or those of another company just to sell me that firewall or whatever it is? And that's also the other side of the coin. If you as a company are looking for help, you will of course get help, but you really don't know if the help is right or wrong. And to be fair, there isn't just one way to do cybersecurity. So there are thousands of ways. One is faster, another is shorter, is cheaper, and another is more expensive. So that means there are so many things you have to consider. And that's where the market is just huge again, making you think about who the right player is in the market and who you should team up with.
Absolutely. And as you said, it's no longer just a technical issue. Security isn't just a product, it's also a process, as the saying goes. This also shows that I can talk to you today not as a technician, but as a political scientist, highlighting that there is indeed very strong socio-political component and that people are a very significant factor in this.
I was really glad to be here. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I wish you and the team continued success in your research. Also, in the way that you will continue on, I was really glad. I also believe that this is a super important topic to look into. Because as I mentioned, these lessons learned, especially in the corporate sector, are done by very few. Instead, it's more like the mode where you just start over and hope that everything will be fine again. So I'm really glad you were here today. And that's it for this episode of Cybersecurity as a Top Priority. And we'll see each other next time.
Thank you very much, Nico, again for the invitation. I really enjoyed being able to talk a bit about Cyber Armageddon. And yes, the best to you for the upcoming podcast episodes.